Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Mona Lena Crook, who's the author of Violence Against Women in Politics. This was published in 2020 by Oxford University Press, and it is a deep dive into this question about violence against women in politics, how we've come to understand this concept and this phenomena, and what its ultimate aim is, as well as charting the phenomenon around the globe. But I'm going to let Mona tell us a little bit more about that as we dive into our discussion about her book. First, I'd like to welcome Mona to the podcast and ask her to tell us a little bit about herself and how she came to this project. Hi, Mona. Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast.
Hi, thanks. Thanks so much for having me. So I'm just really excited to talk about this book, which came out of my earlier research on electoral gender quotas, which are measures that have been adopted around the world to get more women nominated as candidates and elected to political office. And, you know, that was my sort of initial interest in that topic was really to understand, you know, how they got on the agenda, why they were passed, and how effective they were in getting more women into political office around the world. And after I wrote my first book, I started a new project which tried to understand what quotas had meant in a broader sense, what kind of effects it had on the types of women who were elected, what those women did once they got into public office, and how their presence really transformed ideas about gender and political leadership. So when I was doing that second project, I in terms of that last question about how it transformed ideas of political leadership, I thought that really anticipated a positive impact, right? That it would break down, you know, associations between men and politics and really move us towards a more gender equal political world. But something that was sort of coming up increasingly in the interviews I was doing with women around the world, you know, women were talking about resistance and intimidation and harassment and other things that they were facing, what they felt as women in politics. It wasn't just about party politics, but really about resistance to transforming the gender nature of politics. So that's really the reason why I decided to write this book and to really understand what that problem was and why so many women were increasingly talking about this problem, you know, in all different parts of the world. So it's really my effort to bring sort of an academic eye to this phenomenon that is increasingly discussed around the world.
And I certainly wanted to ask you and talk to you about that, because as I saw the title of your book and I started to dig into it, of course, my first thought was about Joe Cox. And because that's one of the more recent events in my lifetime where I have sort of seen an outward manifestation of this kind of violence against women in politics. But you take a very long and comparative look and deep dive into the experiences, as you note, of women around the globe. Can you talk about what, to start with, what we're categorizing as violence against women in politics and why this is a unique categorization?
Okay, so this is really the question I have really grappled with, and really thought a lot about over the last 5 to 6 years that I've been working on this question, because one of the, you know, I think early responses to efforts to talk about this problem were really to try to dismiss it as, you know, look, if women haven't been in politics, suddenly they're in politics and they're experiencing, you know, pushback and intimidation, harassment. That's just what it is to be a politician, right? So maybe it's, we're seeing people talk about this issue because women are just more present, right? And they're experiencing the things that men have experienced for a long time. But I really couldn't escape the fact that so many women that I interviewed, practitioners around the world were really saying that this was something that had a gendered dimension. And as I, you know, delved more deeply into that, I, you know, was looking for frameworks that help explain this, you know, existing frameworks, and really felt that they were overlooking the gendered aspect of, you know, just the mere fact that women have been largely excluded or absent from these political spaces, right? That itself has meant that women's sort of movement into those spaces hasn't just been a seamless one where women taking on the same, you know, experience or status that men have, but that was a change that, you know, certain people were responding to in a negative sort of way. And so I think this is really the starting point. And I think that where I really landed in this was to say that, well, I guess there were two issues to grapple with. One was the argument that, you know, politics is just a hostile space. People, it's just full of conflict, right? That's the nature of political debate. And, you know, political debate is about the theatrical deliverance of violence to the other side. And I thought, well, no, this doesn't seem to just be that, right? And as I went through the political violence literature, the argument about why violence was bad in politics was, okay, so there's some forms of conflict that are democratically valuable, right? The fact that we criticize people for, you know, for their political performances or their policy ideas, right? That contributes to the robustness of democracy. But where it becomes a problematic form, right, where it really becomes violence is when it's about undermining democracy. So work on electoral and political violence often thinks about this as like, you know, when you inflict violence on an opposing side as a way of winning the battle of ideas, right? So this is about intimidating people who vote for the other party. It's about, you know, death threats against your rival, right? It's about those types of things that are really about trying to win that sort of democratic contest through force. And I thought, well, that's not what this is either, right? And so what I really tried to do was to think about how it was different. And so in my book, I argue that violence against women in politics is specifically a phenomenon that is about women's presence in politics. And so while other forms of political violence or, you know, hostility can, you know, be faced by men and women, can, you know, it really revolves around competing political ideas. This was a form that was specifically targeted at women, and it was really about pushing women out, excluding women from politics. And so it was a specific form of gender-based violence. And so in the book, I try to give us some tools for thinking about how we could illuminate a case where gender is sort of a driving motivator behind the attacks. And so I draw on a hate crimes framework, which is all about thinking about how we could find evidence of bias in a particular action or set of acts that could help us understand when it's not just about you know, a particular form of hostility or attack, but it's also about gender-based exclusion. And so this is where I separate out what I'm calling violence in politics from violence against women in politics. But what makes this a very tricky project is the fact that, you know, women who are active in politics experience both of these forms of violence. It's often very difficult to disentangle, right? Like a single experience could have one meaning, but another experience could have a different. Both forms of violence could be present in the same sort of act. But I still think it's conceptually very important and helpful to think about it because, as I argue, violence against women in politics is another threat to democracy and one that we haven't yet fully recognized or appreciated.
And you make that case early on in the book that the violence against women in politics is really about ultimately trying to push women out of the public sphere where they were absent for millennia. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I think this is... you know, it kind of raises really interesting question about if this is just a form of resistance that's always been there to women's inclusion. Is this just sort of the continuation of that exclusion? Or is it a form of backlash, right? So is it the idea that now that women are coming into these spaces, it sort of heightens the resistance, right, that was previously there? And I think it's not surprising that we're seeing more discussion of this, you know, in the years after quotas have spread so rapidly around the world, because suddenly we do have a lot of challenges to the existing, you know, frameworks of male domination in politics that might mean, you know, taking stronger steps to keep women out.
And again, it's not necessarily that there's a big organized cabal. And that's one of the points that you make is that there's all kinds of different levels of this that are going on, and that it's also more of a hidden problem. As you said, you were sort of surprised by the women who were telling you this as you were interviewing them. Can you talk a little bit about why you found this to be somewhat of a hidden problem?
My starting point for thinking about how to organize the book was to start with what Betty Friedan, who was a very famous second wave feminist in the United States, called the problem with no name. And this idea that women's experiences or the experiences of members of other marginalized groups, their experiences often aren't given a name, right, in a culture that marginalizes them. So a lot of the work of practitioners, politicians, activists around the world has really been about trying to name this problem. And one of the most fascinating observations I've had, it's repeated in some of, you know, the early publications by like UN Women and the National Democratic Institute, was that, you know, women will say, oh, you know, I don't face this problem. But when you help to define it or give them some concepts, they're like, oh, yeah, of course, I felt that. But they had sort of, you know, kind of either normalized it as what they would experience as a politician, or they would normalize it just as violence that women face more generally, right? Like women in society, we face sexism every single day. But you just get so used to it that you don't even really realize it's there, right? And so a lot of this this debate is about trying to give a name, to give some concepts to help women really make sense of their experiences. And I think what's so important, just like it was to Betty Friedan, was to say this is not an individual problem. This is a structural, systemic problem. This is not about you as an individual, but about the fact that people like you haven't been, you know, fully recognized as political actors. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different mechanisms for why it's remained, you know, a problem with no name. And the very first chapter of the book, I talk about four different kinds of gaps or barriers to women's recognition. One is a sort of a cognitive barrier, which is just like the difficulty in sort of seeing yourself as a sort of victim or a victim of discrimination. And I think that's very powerful in many parts of the world, right? Your sort of self-concept isn't somebody who's victimized. So I think there's definitely a cognitive gap. There's also a political one, which is that many women want to be able to want to speak out about this issue, but they either think it is going to make them look like they're not strong, right? So it kind of undermines the case for seeing them as leaders, or they think that it will make their own party look bad. And I think what really you know, makes this such a, I don't know, a sharp, a deep problem is that the emerging research on this shows that the main perpetrators of violence against women in politics are members of women's own political parties, or members of their own families. And that's not surprising for somebody who studies violence against women, because women experience violence at the hands of people they know. Like that's the most common form of violence, right? Women most likely to experience that form of violence. And so speaking out about violence is often about speaking about out about, you know, colleagues or leaders or mentors within your own party. And so you also have an incentive not to to speak out for that reason. And then there's just, I think, a third one. It has just to do with receptivity, right? So you're willing to speak out, but nobody is willing to listen, right? Or they mock your claims. And we see this even just last week in the wake of the U.S. Capitol insurrection, where Tucker Carlson, who's a Fox News reporter, was mocking Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for saying that she was scared during the attacks. Well, she had very good reasons to be scared, because she was, you know, has been targeted for a very long time with different acts of violence against her as a female politician, right? And so this idea of like, if you speak out, no one's gonna really gonna listen to you, right? Or willing to take your issues seriously. So some women, knowing that's gonna happen, don't speak out. And then the last one just has to do with resources. And I this was really something that was expressed by women who have been in politics for many, many, many years, often retired politicians. And they say, you know, I knew this was a problem, but who would I tell? Right? Either they're the only woman there, or there's just no, you know, no office. They're when really talking about the issue. You don't really have the resources to be able to do something about it. So you just remain silent. But what is amazing is the fact that this has really, you know, shifted with more and more women speaking out, especially as the problem has been named more and more in public debates.
And in that regard, I mean, I just remember some of the issues around when a lot of the Me Too sort of dams burst. And people, women said, you know, I couldn't complain, or I couldn't go someplace to talk about this, because the person I have to go to is the one who's doing it, which we've known in terms of a lot of the research on these areas of harassment for so long, that the structure is very difficult to negotiate. But I wanted to ask you also, you structure the book not only with regard to sort of unpacking this concept and going through some of the difficulties, but you also do it in a really nuanced and complex way, looking at the global South and the global North, where women have had these experiences. Can you talk a little bit about why that sort of structural comparison was the one that started to frame the research?
The thing that one of the things I was really interested in trying to do in the early stages of this project was just to understand how this problem came to be named and what was it being named as. And as I, you know, was doing research in different parts of the world, you know, because I, as a quota researcher, I also did like cross-regional work. That's always been really important to my sort of approach to academic research. But I discovered that it really, these naming efforts really had parallel origins across different parts of the global South. The first area that I came to be aware of was in Latin America, because as I was starting to do work on this topic, there were a number of Latin American countries that were, including country Mexico, where I was doing research on quotas, where there were bills being proposed to deal with this issue they called political violence and harassment against women. And I, you know, sort of tracing it back, I found out it was started in Bolivia, and then you saw, four or five, six, and seven countries adopting, various initiatives that were recognizing this issue of political violence and harassment against women as a specifically gender-based form of violence. But then as I was sort of exploring the topic, I discovered a number of publications from the mid-2000s that were from a group of sort of a network of female politicians in South Asia. It was organized by a group called South Asia Partnership International, which works in Nepal, but also with offices in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and other places in the region. And they were calling it violence against women in politics. And it was interesting because the way they were sort of approaching the topic was that it was a specifically South Asian problem and something that really was sort of unique to the region. So they didn't seem to have any sort of awareness about what was going on in Latin America, although it was at the same time. And then finally, I had the opportunity to go to Kenya with a grant. And I was talking to a number of organizations there where the issue had also been around. And I realized that it had emerged through an election, a very contested election they had in 2007, which spilled out into violence in 2008. And they were calling it electoral gender-based violence. So here you have like three completely, you know, different parts of the world, right? But all the global South using slightly different words, but it was really about the same issue. It was about women being targeted as women, as actors in the political sphere. And so as I'm sort of like coming to think about this, you mentioned, you know, Joe Cox, that was in 2016. At the same time, we saw, the U.S. presidential election, which was full of examples of sexism and misogyny. There were also in France, which is another country that I also study quite a bit, a huge sexual harassment scandal came out then, a huge public debate. And it really sort of seemed to be a moment when more and more women in the global north were also starting to talk about this, not in a sort of group-based collective way as they had done in the global south, but with these individual experiences. But because different practitioners around the world had been talking about it in the global south, right, they were like, wait, okay, they started to make those connections themselves that actually this is sort of showing that this is something that is just like violence against women, which is a universal global problem. It affects women at all ages, all ethnic groups, all socioeconomic classes. This is the same thing with violence against women in politics. It affects women around the world. And it's something that we shouldn't see as being a problem only in one particular part of the world. And so that I think is a huge part of building the global momentum to recognizing it as a global problem. And I would just say, you know, off in the early days in talking about this issue, people say, well, you know, it's not really a problem in the United States. But I'm just really delighted to tell you that a couple of months ago, there was a resolution introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives recognizing violence against women in politics as a global phenomenon and calling on the U.S. government to recognize it as a problem in both the U.S. and abroad. So I think that it's really, we're just sort of seeing a deepening of an understanding of this as something that is a shared experience amongst many politically active women around the world.
And you brought up Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as an example, but can you, and of course we already mentioned Joe Cox, who was murdered, but can you talk about the spectrum of what the women that you've spoken to and who have been, you know, sort of coming together in community or in groups, what they're talking about in terms of this kind of violence against women who are in politics, where what they are defining as the violence against them?
Yeah, okay. So, feminist researchers have often thought about violence against women as existing on a continuum or on a spectrum, arguing that we shouldn't just think about it as physical violence or physical force, which I think is the more I'd say everyday common understanding about what violence is. So in my book, I adopt a feminist lens to say it's not just about physical forms of violence. But obviously that's part of this phenomenon as well. So in the book, I talk about five different types of violence. So physical violence, we could include under that things like murders, right? Joe Cox, somebody like the Brazilian politician Marielle Franco, who was killed a few years ago. She was a local councilor in Rio. We could also put under the category of physical violence things like attempted assassinations. We could think about Malala Yousafzai, the very famous girls' education advocate. So forms of, I think, physical violence are definitely included under this umbrella. But I think the other forms of violence are more common. So the second type I talk about is psychological violence. And psychological violence is something that's recognized in international treaties on violence against women, which is really about, you know, things like death threats, rape threats, online attacks against women in politics. So that's the form, I would say. The Interparliamentary Union did a study. They found that over 80% of the women they had interviewed had experienced a form of psychological violence like that. A third type is sexual violence. It's also a form of violence against women or recognized international treaties, which is sexual harassment. And also, you know, rape, obviously, so other forms of sexual assault. And sexual violence is interesting. It was one of those topics that I think it's been really difficult for women to speak up about. In the Interparliamentary Union's report, they asked women, had they personally experienced different forms of violence? And then did they know someone else? Did one of their colleagues, had they witnessed it happen to one of their colleagues, you know, that form of violence? And all the forms of violence they look at, it's really relatively similar what they experience and what they've seen happen to other women, except for sexual violence. It's a pretty big gap where, you know, maybe one in five will say they personally experienced, but one of three would say, well, I know another woman it happened to, right? So even in a system where, you know, a moment where they could speak up about it, I think there's a hesitance to talk about it. But that was a study that was done in 2016. In 2017, it was the beginning of the Me Too movement. And we see a lot more discussion of that issue around the world. The fourth type I talk about is economic violence, which is a form of violence that's increasingly recognized in laws around the world and the Council of Europe's Istanbul Convention. And that's really about using various forms of access to economic resources as a form of coercion or intimidation. So these are things like property destruction, not just destroying women's campaign materials, but also, you know, setting fire to their houses, you know, vandalism of their offices, meant to really intimidate them from doing their political work. And then the fifth type of violence is one that I developed in the book. It's not, you know, not yet widely recognized. And I call it semiotic violence. And this is something that came out of inductively from the materials that I was looking at. So semiotic violence is a little bit different from the other forms, but I think, you know, intuitively to me, I think it might be the most common form of violence against women in politics. And this is about using words, images, body language, even to send a message that women are illegitimate actors in the political space. So these would be things like, you know, photoshopped images spread online about, you know, with women in very like highly sexualized positions. We could think about deep fake videos that make women look like, you know, there were some deep fake videos of Nancy Pelosi where it looked like she was slurring her words, right? So that like just making women look like they're incompetent. It's not so much about sending those videos to the women in the images, you know, to Nancy Pelosi, but it's really about trying to sort of plant or exploit, you know, a predisposition to think that women aren't legitimate, women aren't competent, they're not qualified to be political actors. And so that's a fifth type of violence that I talk about. And I think, you know, from all those examples, you can see that if we just focus on physical violence, that really only gives us a very small, you know, lens at which to sort of recognize this as a problem that affects women around the world.
I was really fascinated by the fifth type, as you say, that you developed, because I was intrigued by the idea not only of the sort of concept of semiotic violence, but also how prevalent it is. I mean, as you note, it's sort of, you know, sort of using words and images and even descriptors and asking the questions of women that are not asked of men in particular ways in politics that really sets up a different sort of situation and often undercuts women's capacities, or it seems to try to undercut women's capacities. I know there's a lot of work that's been done in, you know, gender and politics to look at this kind of comparison between men and women in politics. And I really appreciated that sort of fifth bucket that you defined in your work. It was really fascinating. I did want to also ask you, because you do sort of get into this area, that you're talking about the violence against women in politics, but you also note that there are others who are connected, like journalists or activists, who also experience some of this. Can you talk about some of the distinctions between these particular groups and how that figured into your research?
Yes. So this is another one of the... I think things that I'm trying to do in this book, which is that, you know, I came to this topic, and I think most examples I've been using, unfortunately, so far in this discussion, it relates to women in elected political positions or appointed political positions, women who are politicians. But one of the things that just sort of came up, I started to become more and more aware of, was that there were parallel campaigns going on during the same time period, focusing on women in other types of political roles. And the first are campaigns on violence against women human rights defenders, which is something that emerged, you know, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when, you know, women, women's activists, women's human rights activists argued that women's rights are human rights at the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. And so there was this, you know, effort to say that people who focus on women's rights are also people who defend human rights. And so women, you know, as became more visible and started to, yes, as human rights defenders, really also started to face very gender-based forms of attack that weren't simply, you know, the same that human rights defenders who were men or who focused on more traditional, you know, human rights issues faced. And so there's been a whole network around documenting violence against women human rights defenders, collecting data on the question, empowering women with tools, right? So groups talking about integrated security, that it's not just about wearing bulletproof vests, right? But like all different, thinking about security in a more holistic sort of way. And this is a discussion that's really gone in parallel to the violence against women in politics in the sort of politician sense. And then there was this third group who were working in the journalism space, where people who thought about violence against journalists also recognized that women who were journalists were increasingly facing gender-based attacks, especially issues of sexual violence, potential sexual violence in the field. You know, both were reporters, but you know, reporters in all different kinds of spaces and different topic areas. And so, one of the things that I try to argue in this book is that we should adopt a definition of violence against women in politics that doesn't just think about formal politics. politicians, but thinks about women in a wide variety of political roles. So it could be voters, it could be activists, it could be party members, right? Really women who are trying to participate in politics in some sort of way, right? And so we can think about journalists also in this sense, because they are about contributing to public discourse. It's about freedom of expression as well. And so one of the things that I think would be great would be sort of the joining of forces, right, to recognize some of the continuities and shared challenges in these sort of separate campaigns to bring light to this issue, because it's really at the heart, it's all the same. It's about women's ability to participate equally, fully, safely in debates the way that men can do.
And I wanted to also ask you, because you note in the book, just as you were just talking about, sort of some of the responses to like the human rights workers, that the book itself is also not just a scholarly undertaking, but also one that is suggesting practical ideas for responding to this. Can you get into a little bit of that, which is often part of the feminist undertaking? It's not just thinking, but it's also doing. And what you sort of started to carve out as possibly ways to help with this problem.
Yeah, it was actually quite fascinating. A very early paper that I wrote with Juliana Restrepo-Sanin, who is one of my graduate students. We wrote a really early paper about violence against women in politics, and the last section was on solutions. And one of the reviewers just said, "I don't understand why that's there. Like, we're political scientists, we don't, you know, really care about solutions or ways to fix it, you know." And I think that she and I were like, "Well, but we've just spent all this time talking about this problem. Wouldn't you want to, you know how people are trying to fix it?" So it was very important to me that in the book that I also spent a good amount of time, you know, I do a lot of, you know, classifying and typologizing, right? So underneath physical violence, there are like different types of physical violence, right? Under psychological violence, different types of psychological violence. But I devoted the second part of each of those chapters to, you know, emerging solutions, right? So what do we see in terms of potential solutions to physical, right? To psychological, to economic, right? To semiotic violence, et cetera. As well as I have a chapter later in the book that looks at cross-cutting solutions that try to cut across those different, you know, tackle multiple forms of violence at the same time. And, you know, it's actually, you know, despite, you know, the newness of this issue, there's actually quite a wide range of solutions that have emerged around the world. And I think it's so important, especially at this early stage, to really share it and to, you know, shed light and learn and to try to help one another. So this was a book that I wrote for academics, but also very much for practitioners, right? People out in the field who are, you know, living this, these experiences and want to know what they can do to take, you know, to do something about it as well.
And in terms of that, have you had responses from individuals who've read the book, who are practitioners or who are academics, about the proposals for, you know, solving some of these problems?
Yeah, well, so since 2015, I've actually worked very closely with the National Democratic Institute, which is a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C., that it does a lot of electoral assistance, democracy work around the world. And so I've worked very closely with their Gender, Women, and Democracy team on this issue. So the book is, you know, partly, you know, driven by some of my exchanges with them. There's also been so many practitioners working on this issue over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, especially in UN Women, in the Organization of American States, the Inter-American Commission of Women, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. There's a lot of practitioners who've been working in this area, and they have, you know, come together with each other. They've come together with practitioners, and have been to a lot of events where, female politicians, leaders from different parts of the world have come together to talk about, you know, give testimonies of their experiences as well. And so this, I think, is you know, a type of project that really emerged from interchanges between academics and practitioners. And so we are sort of trying to work together to try to help sort of push the agenda forward. And so what I did in the book was not to talk about hypotheticals, but actually just give some examples of like, oh, you know, there are legal reforms. Did you know there are legal reforms, right? And talk a bit about some of the laws that have been passed to deal with this issue. Or, you know, more informal strategies developed by, you know, female party members to deal with issues of sexual harassment, right? Or online online abuse. And as much as I could, I'd also try to kind of give tell it in the first person, some of the accounts that women have given about these different strategies. And so I felt like it was really important to really be grounded in the actual experiences of things that have already, you know, been deployed and sort of emerged from the ground out of efforts to deal with this problem.
And you also have a website that's connected to this book. Is that correct?
I do. And so that was very much something that I felt was really important to do, that to recognize that this was going to be a book that was published at like a finite moment in time, but that this was a discussion that was very much ongoing, right? There's ongoing debates, there's ongoing data collection, ongoing, you know, experiments in practice. So set up I'm calling it a companion website to the book at vawpolitics.org. There you can find a list of all, you know, existing, as far as I know, practitioner and academic reports and publications. I'm constantly adding to that because it really is a very fast-moving field. Also have links to, for example, recent international, you know, declarations or legal reforms, you know, to also just give some help, right? Just to give some examples of things that can be done. I also created a sort of related Twitter account at VAW Politics, which I tried to, you know, share, you know, news items as well as to sort of promote the research that's come out on this topic. So, for example, last 2 weeks, I've been retweeting a lot about the U.S. Capitol attacks and, you know, the sort of dimensions of violence against women in politics that were present then, and, you know, some of the accounts, the testimonies, the analysis coming out of that particular event as well. So it's really, those are meant to keep things up to date, right, and keep that conversation going, and, you know, also to bring in other people's voices. It's not just me who's working on this, but a lot, you know, a whole community of people who are contributing to our knowledge on this topic. And so that's a place to go to learn more about that work as well.
And I will definitely link to those two places in the blog post that goes along with the podcast. But I wanted to ask you now, Mona, what is it that you're working on following up to this big project and your hands-on work that you're doing with a number of institutes and with the website? Have you moved to a different zone, or are you following a similar research stream?
So I've been working, as I mentioned, with the National Democratic Institute for a long time. 2016, we launched what we call the Not the Cost campaign to stop violence against women in politics. Not the Cost being sort of rejoinder to the idea that violence is just the cost of women's participation. It's about denormalizing, accepting it as something that's just par for the course. So we're currently working on a sort of an updated global call for action, which is what we launched in 2016, 5 years later. So that will be coming out in March, and, you know, in connection with UN's Commission on the Status of Women meetings that happen around March every year. I've also been working on the concept of semiotic violence because I think there's a lot more to say on that issue, and to sort of link it more broadly to some thinking about this. And the third thing I'm working on has to do with thinking about violence against women in politics in historical in a historical way, and specifically in terms of violence against women and suffrage movements. And it's just something that, because I happened to be writing this book during some of the suffrage centennials, the US and the UK, I really recognized that quite a number of things that women experienced at that time were also forms of violence against women in politics, the five types that I mention. And so I just been sort of dipping into that. But I think it's an example that really shows us that this is about resistance to women's political rights and as a question of women's citizenship. And I think that there's so many more things we can do with this topic going into the future. And I'm really excited to pursue those.
Well, I would be happy to welcome you back onto the New Books in Political Science podcast when any of those projects are completed. So I would love to speak with you again. Thank you for joining me today, Mona Alina Crook, author of Violence Against Women in Politics. This was published by Oxford University Press in 2020. I assume it is quite available at the Oxford University Press website. Any place else that you might want to mention?
Just really anywhere that books are normally found. It's also available as an ebook in addition to softcover and hardcover editions.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mona.
Thanks so much, Lily.